This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our AI webinar, Boom or Bubble. I'm Laura Brown, and I'm head of public markets distribution at L&G, and welcome you all to spend the time with us this afternoon. We decided to have this webinar in response to public demand. We've all probably lost count of the number of press articles, conference presentations, LinkedIn posts, if they're a measure of anything in the world, that there are on the topic of AI. Even this morning, I had to lower my voice at the breakfast table to avoid scaring the children when showing my husband an article in the FT with a chart today depicting various economic scenarios that might unfold with the rise of AI. One of the lines depicted on this graph was human extinction, which was rather unsettling over the cornflakes. And needless to say, in the event of human extinction, you see rather a swift drop off in GDP to zero. Although I did think that's human GDP, I guess we can't speak for what robot GDP would be doing in that scenario. For balance, I should say there was also a line that took off into the stratosphere in terms of GDP growth. And I think at the heart of it, this example is really helps us kind of illustrate the difficulties that we face when we think about AI in terms of investment and in terms of the wider world. There are so many different scenarios, so many different views, and a wide kind of range of outcomes that people are articulating. I think it's also interesting because it kind of viscerally, intuitively, we all understand what AI is. We're increasingly using it at work, increasingly using it at home. My husband is an avid ChatGPT user. He's also a maths teacher, and he tells me that it's getting a lot better, albeit not perfect, in relation to secondary school maths questions. But when it comes to cryptic crossword clues, it's still nowhere close. So there's hope for humans yet. I'd like to introduce my panel today. I'm joined by Chris Jeffrey, who's head of macro strategy, Jason Shoup, who is co-head of fixed income and our US CIO, and Matteo Colombo, who is a managing director in our private markets business and leads on our digital infrastructure investment. Thank you for joining me. So I'm going to start by asking Chris. Obviously, AI has been one of the dominant themes in the last couple of years from an investment perspective, but perhaps you could talk us through its impact on markets year to date in 2025.
Sure. I mean, I was thinking about what GDP per capita means in the human extinction scenario. On the road there, it's very strong. So what does it mean? What has it meant in 2025? Well, most obviously, it's just been a huge tailwind for equity prices and risk assets. So I think AI and the AI earnings growth that we've seen has been the single most important factor to help us dragging markets out of that slump that we saw in March and April. The Magnificent Seven up 25% year to date and a pretty spectacular 300% over the last 3 years. AI-focused indices have been even stronger this year, with 35%+ returns in some cases. So more broadly, though, that tech dominance is quite interestingly in previous years, it's typically been associated with US outperformance. That's not the story of 2025. So European stocks have kept up. The boring old FTSE 100, full of old industry names of in finance and commodities, has been the outperformer, up nearly 25% year to date. So it's kind of beneath the headlines of AI outperformance, we've seen these kind of interesting cross currents with international diversification paying off more than in previous years. And then also interesting, I think, is the performance of safe haven assets. So you'd normally think when equities are that strong that the bond market has quite a tough time. That's not been the story of 2025, despite all of the headlines around tariffs and deficits and debt trajectories. You've actually seen government bonds rally this year. Can we pin that on AI? Maybe. There's obviously a sort of deflationary or disinflationary version of the future, which AI possibly brings. Credit markets, I'm going to leave Jason to talk about this. Just to note, credit markets had been rallying with equities pretty much all year up until about a month ago, when a few question marks are starting to get raised about the amount of capital issuance that is required to fund the CapEx spend, and are debt investors, credit investors in the US in particular, people who are going to have to put the money forward. So in aggregate, I'd say a big, big tailwind. There's been interesting kind of cross currents internationally, which hasn't been true in the previous years of this boom. Safe haven assets seemingly enjoying that slight disinflationary trend, and credit, well, that's one for Jason. He's the expert on the call.
That's great. I guess it feels early in this call to ask this question, but I guess the thing on everyone's minds is, of course, do you see this as an AI bubble? And yeah, I've got to ask you to give us your thoughts on that one.
Yeah, thank you for the easy question early on. So I'm going to start with a definition, and I like the definition from Eugene Fammer in 2014, that a bubble is an irrationally strong price increase that implies a predictable strong decline. So a two-part definition. I think the two parts are important. Is the price increase we've seen today irrational, and does it predict a strong decline in the future? So taking the first one. I've said already, Mag 7 returns up 300% in the last 3 years. So that is a huge number. But earnings for the Mag 7 have tripled since 2021. Gross margins for the Mag 7 have been steady at 50%. Free cash flow has grown similarly to earnings, so and running at around $400 billion per annum, meaning that the AI capex rollout in large part, not exclusively, in large part is being self-financed by the hyperscalers. So is the concentration risk concerning that comes with this? Absolutely. Is that a concern? Yes. Is it irrational that we've seen the price response that we have in response to such strong earnings and free cash flow growth? I don't think so. So I don't think you meet the irrationality bar. And then that gets me to the second part of the definition. I guess the one that everyone really cares about. Is there a predictable strong decline around the corner? Like, is the bubble gonna go pop? Bubble's only a bubble if it pops. And there I'd just say, for any given sector over the course of the last 100 years in the US, there's been about a 1 in 10 chance of a crash risk on a 2-year investment horizon. When you've seen the kind of run-up that we've seen in the Mag 7, that rises to about 1 in 3. So how do we think about that? Crash risk is elevated. Yeah, that would be consistent with the historical record, but doesn't mean a crash is likely. I mean, we're still less than 50%. In those 2/3 of scenarios where strong run-ups have not crashed, guess what? They've led to continued strong returns. So if you were to force me to give you a yes or no answer, I would lean on no. If you would allow me a more nuanced answer, I'd say it doesn't meet the definition of irrationality or predictable strong decline that is implied with the use of the word bubble.
Nice. I'm glad. It's always good when you get a yes or no answer. So we can hold you to that in future webinars and see how we get on. Jason, I want to turn to you now, and obviously the US is absolutely at the epicenter of all of this, as it usually is, but perhaps in AI more than even anything. From a macro perspective, and it's kind of coming back to this point about bubbles, human extinction, all the rest of it, do you think AI is ultimately going to disrupt or derail economic growth, or is it going to take off? Is it going to save us?
I think the easy answer is it probably changes the composition of growth in the U.S. quite significantly, as it already has this year, right? So assuming it isn't a bust for the minute, I think you can make an argument that you potentially go from really a consumption, you know, PCE-driven and dominated growth profile in the U.S. to a growth profile where productivity gains and maybe investment are playing a bigger role. For us, I think that the hope is that in the U.S. at least, the hope is that that means an uplift to trend growth of some sort, probably on the order of 30 to 50 basis points is in the reasonable envelope, a little bit less than the utopia line on your graph that you were talking about, and considerably better than, I guess, Terminator, Skynet, the machines take over the world scenario. That may not seem like a lot, 30 to 50 basis points or, half a percentage point uplift to the growth trajectory in the U.S. But in the context of the deficit dynamics that we're contending with in the developed markets and in the U.S. in particular, it could be quite meaningful. And it should be understood that it's really quite difficult to actually impact trend growth in the U.S. with an economy as large as it is in any meaningful direction to begin with, right? So I think there really is the possibility that AI potentially is an answer or helps us deal with very large deficits and reducing them in the future. The two notes of caution that I would maybe throw in into the mix there. One is the timing risk. And to the extent that we see some sort of, you know, J curve in how this manifests into productivity gains, it's very possible that you see, you know, more immediate impacts to employment before the real productivity gains start to show up in the data. That's something we have to think about quite closely. And then the second thing is that increasingly, and this has been alluded to a bit already on the webinar today, the AI investment boom is being debt funded, right? And I think we're at this inflection point. And 2025 will go down as the year where we've transitioned from self-financing, free cash flow financing of, you know, AI infrastructure largely by the mega, you know, the mega tech names and the hyperscalers to relying more on the debt markets to do it. And I guess the risks there are obvious, but you're socializing more broadly the risks of whether this is a bubble across the entire economy, and it's no longer concentrated in the large tech companies.
Now, we kind of just heard Jason talking about the AI boom's implications in the bond market. It also has huge digital infrastructure implications, a lot of that being financed through the private markets, not just public markets. So what sort of infrastructure is most affected, and how do you see that demand evolving?
Yeah, it's a prescient question, Chris, and one that we are both benefiting from and equally thinking about intensely. Digital infrastructure sector has grown in the last few years to become the largest subsector of infrastructure alongside clean power. Together, they make up something like 2/3 of the infrastructure spend. It's worth just taking a step back to also consider that this sector, digital infrastructure here in Europe, really only took off from 2018, which is probably when everyone on this call first remembers starting to do streaming. As a result, generally investor allocations to this sector are relatively underweight compared to portfolio allocations more broadly. So that is worth bearing in mind. And within Europe, we are less allocated to the sector than in the US. The tech companies are predominantly American. Digital infrastructure took off really 3 years, 4 years ahead in the US versus Europe. So allocations over here are less significant from an investor perspective. So that's one kind of macro investment perspective to bear in mind. On the digital infrastructure side, it's on the topic of AI, it's also worth just considering the demand side. The demand side is not driven predominantly in the market by AI. AI today accounts for 5-10% of the market. 60 to 70% of the market demand today is cloud, with the remainder 20-30% being enterprise demand. Clearly AI is the fastest growing. It's growing 30%, cloud kind of more on the 20%, and enterprise in the 10%. So in terms of AI being kind of driving the use of infrastructure and the opportunity, that's not actually correct. It's cloud and enterprise that is driving the digital infrastructure demand. AI is a incremental growth on top. On the digital infrastructure side, supply in particular in data centers has dropped to kind of all-time vacancy lows, so in the low single digits. The infrastructure takes something like 5 to 10 years, up to 15 years to bring on stream. So in terms of risk of oversupply, one can look forward into what's coming on stream and get comfortable, you know, with that supply demand dynamic, that there is not kind of, as a result, near-term oversupply coming on stream. There are nuances. There are facilities being built for build to suit hyperscale demand. There is facilities that service the range of kind of demand. And depending on your current exposure to the sector, you might invest in different manners. But, you know, we are investing in a diversified portfolio across different types of kind of digital infrastructure product, and not overweighting one versus another, because therein kind of creates some risk. I think, you know, there are clearly some drivers that are stronger than others. And depending on your existing portfolio, you can overweight some versus others. There's also geographics that come into it in terms of both where demand is stronger because of, for example, power costs, for example, political policies. So again, we take a diversified approach, and I'd be happy to chat on any specifics. But that, I hope, gives a flavor a little bit on the digital infrastructure kind of universe side. And certainly, as Jason said, the exposure is more heavy on the US side, where the tech players are, you know, based, and also where it has commenced, or the sector has started 3-4 years ago. What we see happening in the US will happen more so into Europe on a delayed, lagged basis.
No, that's very interesting, Matteo. And I guess that idea around, I suppose, some of the myths of AI, digital infrastructure, and what's driving the returns and the investment opportunity is very interesting. You mentioned power briefly there, so I'd be very interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, Laura. On the power side, again, you know, it's actually a first time since the Industrial Revolution that we're talking about being short of power. Until relatively recently, and all of this again is recent, as I say, like digital infrastructure is less than 10 years old, and so with the kind of deindustrialization of the developed economy, we actually had surplus power across the world for a substantial period of time. We now have the, you know, electrification. And again, it's important to understand digital infrastructure is not running on combustion fuels. It is electrical. So it's downstream, the sources of the energy that one needs to consider. However, digital infrastructure and demand follows populations. And so populations are concentrated in certain locations. We're sitting here in London. It's the world's second largest data center market. So clearly, where you have concentrations, you do have constraints on power. Power infrastructure takes, again, 5, 10, 15 years to come on stream, potentially even longer. So where you have demand growing 30% plus CAGR, clearly that power supply cannot meet the growth in demand. So therefore, you end up in a dynamic where those that have the power or the supply in a constrained market can benefit. And so, you know, from our side, we've been investing in the sector since 2018. And, you know, we have got investments that are benefiting from these tailwinds. But if you enter today, blindly, let's put it, certainly you can face overpricing, you can face lack of capacity. But on a global basis, that's why actually it's a global business demand, and there are more opportunities. On power, the other thing to bear in mind is power costs. And what is the use of the digital infrastructure? AI potentially can be located from a research perspective, geographically agnostic. So it's tending to flow to areas where there is more ample supply, where power costs are lower, where there's more renewable. However, if there were to be a bubble and some retreat in demand, that's where you, with that infrastructure, you may face some economic or business plan difficulties. However, where you are located serving cloud, enterprise, as well as AI, you're not as reliant on AI per se. And then within geographies, you know, US is clearly a leading market on the AI side. So if AI were to retract, America would be impacted kind of more. So I hope that gives a little bit of a flavor.
Yes, no, that's really helpful. We've started to have some questions come through from the audience, which is fantastic. Keep them coming. Chris, maybe one for you first. A question around which industries in the wider economy do we think are likely to benefit first from AI?
So I'm guessing this isn't a question about the providers of the tech themselves, because that horse has bolted, I would say. But the industries beyond that, it's going to be the ones who are doing things which are like an element of sort of search equivalent type dynamics are embodied within their workflow. So I don't think it's too much of a surprise that you're seeing quite a lot of headlines about penetration of AI within the legal profession, where, you know, searching through case law is a, you know, decent part of the workload. And it shouldn't be too much of a surprise where kind of helping clients answer their queries, an interrogation of an internal database is kind of helpful, is obviously the other place. So it's anything which just really, in the first iteration of AI, it's building on what we've kind of already seeing. It's large language models which help with interrogation of large sets of data, particularly good at dealing with large reams of human text. So that'd be the places where I'd point to.
I think it's an interesting one, and Jason, maybe ask you to comment on the employment side of it. I know there was a recent report from the World Economic Forum saying that, you know, we're all very concerned that job numbers are going to reduce, but this report talked about actually overall job numbers globally are going to go up. But digging into the detail in areas like food production, which I guess aren't necessarily we're aspiring for our children to enter into as professions. So you touched on employment briefly and your kind of thoughts on the macro impact in the US, but really interested, Jason, in how you see AI kind of feeding through into that.
Yeah, I think, first of all, we don't know. And I think there's a credible case on both sides here that anytime that we've historically seen big technology innovation, we do tend to get concerned about potential job losses. And the history of the world so far is that it ultimately creates jobs, right? But I do think at the same time, there's something unique about what AI can potentially offer. And we shouldn't necessarily rely on that historical contribution or that historical experience and just not worry at all that there will be some sort of employment dislocation or job losses on net. I think the way that we've been thinking about this lately has been really relative to sort of where the consensus is in terms of, you know, the macroeconomic forecast for the next year and what the direction of vulnerability is to that sort of thought. And we've all become very accustomed to this idea of the K-shaped economy, right? This kind of more bifurcated winners and losers type of experience where the top income in the US has been doing a significant amount of the consuming and driving a significant amount of the growth, while, you know, maybe the cost of living challenges that we've had over the last 2 years have been most felt at the bottom. I think one thing to think about, and it comes back to what Chris was saying, when you think about where AI might have the most impact, it's going to be much more in sort of white collar, traditionally median consumer, from an income demographic, jobs, right? And so I think it's a terrible analogy, but I think of the K-shaped economy and the bottom part of the K getting fatter and fatter and fatter and starting to move up the income demographic kind of spectrum. And so from that perspective, that's where I'm, you know, when I'm not worried about the tech space and all the supply that they're bringing and all the bonds that they're bringing, I think when you think about where you need to be looking for companies that might be exposed, it's in that median consumer demographic that I'd be looking for, you know, where the most leverage is. And then the other one that's quite controversial, but we're starting to see it in the U.S. and I guess it's a phenomenon that we've seen in Europe for a while too, is rising youth unemployment. So we have a whole crop of very smart college graduates who've come in and found the job market very difficult right now because a lot of companies have paused their hiring, and that has, you know, most immediately affected the incoming sort of grads that we've had into the labor force. Ironically, they're probably the ones that are most knowledgeable about AI, right? So I think the debate is, you know, does that persist and continue to become a problem in the U.S.? And does that also mean that you need to be very mindful about companies that are leveraged to the, you know, youth consumer? We've seen that in sort of fast casual dining as being one area that has recently cropped up, but I wouldn't suggest that is the end of the story either there.
Oh, that's really interesting. Now, Matteo, I'm going to come back to you in a minute around some of the questions we have on the actual infrastructure side. But in terms of current markets, valuations, et cetera, I guess there's various different questions related to the same topic, you know, things like the fact that's being thrown around Meta getting 98% of their revenues from advertising. What we think about what's been going on over the last couple of days in terms of market valuations, how we feel about price earning ratios and other metrics within the tech sector and how those compare to historical levels. And one other bit just to add into that around the extent to which the companies in that Mag 7 are kind of connected with each other. So the correlation in terms of the stock price movements being potentially more indicative of a bubble. I know I've said a lot of things there, Chris, but maybe start with you and your thoughts on that. And you know, I don't know if Jason would have anything to add as well.
Yeah, okay. So I'd say that if we kind of think about the last few weeks, I guess that was one of the things that you asked about. In the last few weeks, we've seen the market digest an earnings season that at face value has been pretty great so far, that we've seen a very healthy kind of upside surprise in earnings kind of on a market weighted average basis, that we've seen earnings growth year on year remain in double digits for the US, and no kind of serious misses from any of the kind of the really sort of, you know, the big market favorites. But the price action has been a bit more bifurcated than that, kind of a bit more interesting, that you've had the, I'd say, a distinction between the entities which are able to demonstrate that they can monetize this and monetize it pretty quickly, getting market support, and entities which are laying out rather large capex plans without an obvious rapid monetization, not getting that market support. You've kind of already reference Meta, that'd be the kind of biggest one in that category. So I think there's a kind of a bit of a distinction playing out there, which might well lead to lower correlations amongst that Mag 7 group than we have seen before. That feels like it could potentially be quite structural, that you've now going to be entering into a period where, well, like looking backwards, you've gone through a period where all CapEx plans were getting rewarded. Like, you know, the marginal investor seemingly has gone, oh, you want to invest in AI CapEx? Great, I'll have some of that. Whereas now it's, you know, like a distinction is being built into market pricing. And if you looked at like Meta's projections, for example, there was not a rapid path to monetization at all of that large CapEx spend. So I think that's one kind of point of distinction. The other point of distinction is kind of one we've already alluded to, that you've had a bit of a drift apart between the way that the US investment grade credit market is behaving and other risk assets. So none of that kind of drift wider that's material in high yield spreads, none of that's been material in European IG spreads, but something notable in the US market is taking place. You know, it's always a bit dangerous to be sort of pinning it on this one factor, but it does certainly feel like that's the story. In terms of the valuations, yeah, there are, I mean, there are names in the market with absolutely eye-popping price earnings multiples. And the multiple attached to the S&P 500 in aggregate is pretty reminiscent of the late 1990s. So I can kind of completely see where those concerns come from. But I think the big point to make is that thus far, that has been validated by regularly consistent double-digit earnings growth at the index level. And that's going to be the thing that sort of ultimately makes
I feel like I've got to go to Jason for what is, I mean, yeah. Usually our fixed income has a more pessimistic perspective, but go on, Jason.
I'll give you a rather long answer to kind of come back and talk a little bit about investment grade and what's been going on over the last, you know, few weeks here. So we've already talked about this a bit, but I think you can easily say the cat's out of the bag that the debt markets are going to play a big role, right? So over the last 3 to 4 weeks in the U.S., you've had Meta come with a $30 billion deal. You've had Oracle come with an $18 billion deal. You've had Google come with a $24 billion deal across both the dollars and the euro markets. You've had, I guess I would call them pseudo-private JV deals from that involve Meta and involve Oracle that probably account for another, you know, $50 billion of capital that's being raised or so. And then you've had a handful of high yield companies that are also data center builders that have been in the market raising debt for another $10 or $15 billion of capital as well. The idea that a Meta can wake up one day and come to the market and issue $30 billion with no advance notice is really a quite a big shift for investors. The only previous times that we've seen that have really been for M&A transactions. And those are usually well telegraphed. You know, there's investor roadshows, there's an opportunity to ask questions, the market gets well prepared before it lends that much money. Over the last few weeks, we've changed that paradigm quite significantly. We have these large companies that are coming to the market and essentially doing what we call drive-bys. Everyone, I think, is waking up to the idea in the markets, in the debt markets at least, that this is going to continue. And it's quite possible, if you look at the CapEx forecast, that the numbers are just staggering, right? That if you sort of extrapolate out into the out years. I've been paying a lot of attention to various CapEx forecasts over sort of a 3 and 4 year horizon. And I would say that the differentiation at the low end versus the high end is huge. So we've seen forecasts of anywhere from $3 trillion of spending and CapEx investment needed over the next 3 to 4 years to almost double that from McKinsey in the $7 trillion in zone. We mentioned this before, that the ability for the mega cap Mag 7 hyperscalers to fund that with free cash flow has started to hit a limit. Doesn't mean they aren't going to use their free cash flow to do it. And as Chris pointed out, you're starting to see the market to differentiate between potentially companies like Oracle and Meta who are in some sense using all of their free cash flow now to invest and have taken their free cash flow negative in some cases going forward in order to make these investments that, and I think this is a crucial point, they believe may be existential, right, to their ability to continue to be in business 5, 10 years from now. I just want to kind of bring some of those numbers to life, because when someone says there could be $3 trillion of CapEx investment, we hear trillion and it kind of, there's zero context for it in our reality of how to make sense of that into a financial market. The way I think about it is, if you take that $3 to $7 trillion over the next 3 to 4 years, it essentially implies somewhere between 500 and maybe $1 trillion of bond debt that needs to come annually to help support this and support, you know, add to what's going to be spent from free cash flow. what does $500 billion to $1 trillion mean in the bond markets, right? If you look at all of the U.S. bond markets away from the treasury market for a minute, they grew or are on track to grow this year about $1.5 trillion, right? So growth across every bond market, public, private, securitized, investment grade, high yield, the mortgage market, everything that's not a treasury in the U.S., that entire combination of bond markets grows about $1.5 trillion a year. So we're talking about a meaningful increase to the size of the bond markets just coming from the AI trade, and in all of these formats, anywhere from a 30% increase to almost a 100% increase in the growth rate of these bond markets. The other way to frame this, just to kind of put a pin in it, is the treasury market itself grew by about $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion this year. So we're also talking about growth that in AI that's almost on the order, or could be on the order, of what we're seeing growth in the treasury market. That's just staggering. And it's probably the biggest step change that we've seen in the growth rate of bond markets in the last decade or two decades, or perhaps even longer. And I think it begs the question of, how are you going to suck in or attract that much capital from elsewhere in the world and in people's investments to fund it? And I think the logical answer is you're going to need a new sort of equilibrium level, right, of return or spread or whatever metric you want to use to attract that capital. So not to put too bearish a spin on it, but that is the sort of fixed income kind of perspective, and why, you know, the investment grade market, which is sometimes the least volatile, least interesting, least sexy kind of market out there, is sending the, you know, beginnings of the warning signs, I think, more broadly around how important this could be as a change
great.
In the dynamic.
Thank you.
Can I just come in with one tiny bit of, I really like that way you framed it, Jason. I just kind of would frame it. Another way you could frame it is to think about this relative to GDP. So $3 trillion is roughly 10% of US GDP. If we kind of think back to the huge German stimulus announcements at the beginning of the year, that was a kind of similar sort of number being spent on defense and infrastructure. So I guess the point would be, AI is not the only story in town here. You've also got a European economy that's kind of rearming, reinvesting in physical infrastructure. That's going to be 10% of GDP over the course of a decade. You've got AI as well. It's just like a lot of sources of demand for capital. And we've kind of spent so long over so many years talking about there's not enough capex, and suddenly you wait for a bus and
I like this. Yes. So Matteo, switching from public markets to private markets, I guess quite a few of the questions are sort of talking about what if the bubble bursts, what would the market correction look like? So interested from your perspective in the kind of investments that we might make in the private markets into digital infrastructure, how does that play through in terms of the returns and risks that we see if the public markets bubble starts to burst?
Yeah, on the private market side, obviously, we are tending to look a little bit longer term, and we have an investment horizon in the circa 10-year type timescale. And hence what I was saying earlier in my response, one needs to look at the supply-demand dynamic and the timelines for delivering such infrastructure. As Jason says, like, there's a lot of demand forecast for growth and in turn infrastructure. However, in the physical world, dare I say it, things take time to build. So, you know, it's not some of this growth forecasts are based on the CAGRs, but it's physically impossible to build this stuff in the time frames that are needed. So, you know, therein comes innovation. And so it's a really exciting part of the kind of market to be in. One from our side that we look at and consider, you know, is the contracted nature that we are backing on the infrastructure space with our strategy. So And equally the exit horizons. So from our perspective, we tend to be forecasting and acting on investments that we exit within a 10-year horizon. Often our contracted cash flows, which are to the world's kind of most valuable companies, are of a duration even longer than our hold horizon. And then when you layer onto that, that we have exposure to multiple of these players and we can deliver, you know, high teens returns, you know, that is a very attractive dynamic and why we're, you know, very enthused to be investing in this space. I mentioned the sector kind of really took off from 2018. Back then you had, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, Google. You know, today we're talking about Magnificent Seven. It was Magnificent Three. And before it was, you know, at the start of the dot-com, it was like Magnificent One type thing. So the one thing about AI is it's democratizing compute. And that's a really, really great thing, because what that means is people are worried about the power of these big companies, but actually the democratization of compute means that there are other companies that can compete. And NVIDIA, you know, was one of our clients in one of our facilities. You know, they were world's fifth largest company when we first signed them. Today, they're the world's largest company. The point is, you know, from a supply perspective, we have more customers now. So that is a good thing in that it's taking away power. But equally, my point is you don't necessarily want to have all your investment exposure with one customer. On the AI side, there is a self-policing aspect in that we can't get debt lending against neo-hyperscale AI names. That in turn limits the potential growth of them and exposure to leverage on those names. So there are a number of dynamics that, you know, self-police some of this and increase competition on a limited supply capacity makes one able to have some visibility on investments and get comfortable with, you know, investments of a 5-7 year horizon.
No, that's really interesting. We haven't got much time left, but I just have had lots of questions and I wanted to ask you this one, Matteo, which was around, you know, the importance of data centers, digital infrastructure to kind of the very workings of society. And if there is a risk in terms of these kind of companies, these kind of situations becoming too big to fail, a need for government backstops, systemic risk around all of this. What are your thoughts on that area?
Well, it's obviously a very broad question you've asked.
I'm afraid, yes.
but one thing I would like to say is that I see data centers, digital infrastructure as the solution to renewable power. We as a society need renewable clean power. Electric vehicles, you know, as we're seeing, are not going to get us there in its entirety. Economics comes into play. You know, Jason's been talking about credit. You know, in order to fund something, you need a contracted cash flow with sufficient credit quality to anchor a large infrastructure spend, which is very sizable in amount. So, you know, having building nuclear, building large scale renewables, you need a counterparty contract and size and scale that the hyperscalers with data centers can offer. Why does that not exist today? As I said at the very start of our conversation, this sector is brand new in the sense it's 2018. We do not have data centers of scale of 100 megawatts fully leased in Europe. In America, starting to be. Once you have those kind of facilities, which we're going to come to in the coming few years, we can then have mega scale renewable projects, power utility projects that are backed by that. In turn, that allows electric cars to actually be able to plug in, because at the moment you buy it, you can't plug it in. You know, that's because there's a shortage of power. So we're entering a kind of And so I see digital infrastructure and the tech companies really helping us solve that. So in that respect, I hope that gives a little bit of perspective.
That does. That's really interesting. And I think it's probably a good moment to wrap us up as a result. One of the sort of thematic questions coming through was around really what's next in terms of robotics, transformation of physical work. How does society and, you know, finance transform even more in relation to those things? So it feels like there's good fodder there for a future. You know, what are the further implications of all of this, you know, and interest from our clients. But for now, we'll leave it there. I guess we'll continue to observe through the rest of 2025 whether Chris is right and it's not a bubble, and into 2026. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you to my panelists. It's been a really, really interesting discussion. And let's hope that we avoid the human extinction. Happy weekends all. Thank you.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. Economic the views expressed in this podcast are those industry of L&G's Asset Management Division. It does not constitute as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities. The information discussed is general market and economic. Or political assumptions, issues, opinions, or industry and estimates provided for illustrative purposes. It does not constitute only. Research, there is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. It is no recommendation of any right or advertisement against L&G in relation to the accuracy or complete investment information contained in this podcast. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates contained in third-party information only. The accuracy there is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. And no party no responsibility or liability in relation to the accuracy or complete distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where this podcast contains would be contrary to local law, the accuracy or complete copyright information cannot be guaranteed. Legal and we accept no responsibility limited or liability and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Not for distribution to any person otherwise stated, any jurisdiction references herein to L&G, we would be contrary to local law meant to calculate the global copyright 2025. In the European and economic area, LGM manages authorized and regulated authorized by the Central Bank of Ireland. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and communities are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes in the European regulation area, LGM manages Europe Limited as an authorized and regulated fund manager, Bank of Ireland, as the European Union Management Company, pursuant to European Managers Regulation, undertaking to form collective investment in the USA, Legal and General Investment 2011, America, amended, Inc., and a US alternative SEC regulated manager, pursuant to the European Union Legal and General Investment Management Fund Managers Regulation, Japan, FSA, registered in the USA, Management Company, Legal and General Hong Kong, Investment issued by Legal and General Investment Management, a US SEC regulated licensed advisor in Japan, Legal and General Investment Management, Japan, KK, Japan, FSA BT registered in company registration number in Hong Kong issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Securities and Futures Commission. For full terms and conditions, please issued by LGM. To find more content, you can check us out on company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority.